Welcome back to the program. We all remember stories of espionage during the Cold War. The rainy, gray streets of Eastern Europe, the moral twilight of Le Carré, U-2 flights, prisoner exchanges on a deserted bridge. Today, espionage has gone digital, with keystrokes rather than microfilm, with the likes of hackers like Kevin Mitnick replacing James Bond. At the same time, the stakes have never been higher, as all of our secrets are more vulnerable than ever. Just this week, we've heard the story of the control of U.S. drone flights being hacked. Arguably, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to talk about all of this with our guest, Joel Brenner. He's a former senior counsel at the National Security Agency, where he advised on legal and policy issues relating to national security. Previously, he served as the National Counterintelligence Executive in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. It is my pleasure to welcome Joel Brenner here to talk about his new book, America the Vulnerable: Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Joel Brenner, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, it's a pleasure to be here and share part of the morning with you and your listeners.
Well, great to have you here. How serious is this threat? When we look at it, we've been told for a long time that certainly in this digital age, privacy is something that we have to compromise. How serious is the threat to our national security from all of this?
Well, it's a threat to security at every level, personal, corporate, and national, because we've taken this marvelous internet, which has been such a source of wealth, interest, and pleasure, but it wasn't meant to be the backbone of commerce, finance, and industry, and that's what we've made it into. And by hooking up everything to everything else, we've made everybody's secrets, personal, corporate, and national, extremely vulnerable and available to other people, so that instead of the spy stories now just being, as you were saying, Jean Le Carré in Berlin in 1960, we're talking about the remote penetrations of both corporate and national networks in order to steal economic and national secrets. And we are being hollowed out from the inside of the technology that creates wealth and jobs. I want to emphasize that. This is not just a problem for the people who run companies, but for all of us.
And to what extent are we doing the same thing with respect to other places in the world?
Really good question. Our adversaries, some of them don't believe this, but the American intelligence apparatus is not used in the service of the commercial interests of American companies. The Russians do it. The Israelis and the French do it. The Chinese do it big time. But we don't. And there are a couple of reasons that we don't. One is that protecting intellectual property is a bedrock strategic goal of American foreign policy. And so we're not going to violate our strategic principles for some short-term tactical advantage. And even if you were really cynical about this sort of thing, Jeff, you'd look around and realize that, who's got the most stuff to steal? We do. So we have a real interest in maintaining the rule of law when it comes to commercial property. The Chinese don't, and the Chinese, frankly, don't have a whole lot to steal, and neither do the Russians. So that's why we don't do it.
What about the degree to which we are doing it for national security purposes, though, not corporate purposes?
Well, all countries engage in espionage, and the United States does too. I can't talk about anything specific in that regard, you'll understand. But this is what's really different here is that this isn't just states on states. We've got governments on governments. The traditional stuff. People say, it's just espionage. But we've got now foreign intelligence services and their surrogates targeting General Motors, Ford, and little companies, too. A lot of our companies don't think that they're big enough to be targets, but if they've got interesting technology, the Chinese and the Russians in particular are after it. And I have clients who really who found this out the hard way. I'm trying to describe something based on what I've seen and do it in a way that doesn't sound like we got our hair on fire. This is a problem that's not going to get solved all of a sudden. It's not going to blow us up. It's the slow hollowing out of what's happening and the change to both in, you know, intelligence and businesses, how we do business.
And to what extent are the highest levels of government and the corporate world, large corporations at least, although you talk about that this is affecting small businesses as well, to what extent is there an awareness of this and an ongoing effort to at least try and stay one step ahead of it?
Well, Jeff, I got to say that I'm pretty unhappy with what I see. There are some exceptions in the financial world, in the gaming world, but by and large, American businesses are not taking this seriously. I and people like me get called in once they realize they've got a problem or been taken to the cleaners. But, you know, if you think about the things you need to do to control your network, which is, okay, who's on it? Do I know who's on it? Do I know what hardware and software are on it? Do I know what traffic's going through it? There are very few companies that do all of these things, and frankly, most companies don't do any of them. And that's not a technological problem. It's a management problem, which can be dealt with without spending millions of dollars, but it takes a certain corporate awareness and corporate will to do it.
How much of it is also a generational problem in that the people that are leading our government agencies dealing with this and our corporations that are dealing with this don't have a clear enough understanding of the technological aspects of all of this?
No doubt this is a big part of it. I mean, I couldn't quantify it, but this is just not something that most captains of industry have grown up with. Although that's changing. That's changing pretty mm-hmm. fast. And I don't think we're going to be able to say that a whole lot longer. But, you know, people, new companies and startups are always starved for capital. And so if they don't see a problem and know it's happening, they don't want to spend money on it. The larger companies are just, frankly, behind the eight ball. Most of them, anyway. And as I say, I see it after, you know, somebody's pockets have been turned inside out. It's a lot cheaper to deal with the problem
right.
before that happens.
What is the balance between public policy on the one hand and individual corporate responsibility on the other? And how does that nexus work?
Well, the problems that I've just been describing, the government's not going to solve them for you. Companies have to deal with that themselves. But there are things the government could be doing much, much better than it is. For example, I think that the if you look at the biggest purchaser of goods and services in the country, I think it's got to be the Defense Department. Their standards, their procurement standards, could really drive security much more forcefully than they do. That's one big change we could do. We also we don't even let our ISPs, our internet service providers, you know, the AT&Ts mm-hmm. and the Verizons of the world, they know what sort of criminal botnets are being operated through their systems. Why don't they take them down? Really good question. And if you ask some of these guys sort of off the record, if they know you well enough to talk candidly, they'll say, oh, it's the privacy laws don't do it. Don't let us do it. And you say, what? Privacy is we don't have privacy laws to protect criminal organizations, but interfering with traffic is thought by most readers of these statutes to be impossible. I think it's not a full explanation of it myself, but we need to be able to take down these criminal organizations, and it's not just to prosecute them. You can't prosecute everybody; they're too many. You need to make the networks a lot tighter. We don't do that very well.
Are there inherent problems in making those networks tighter, given the way the networks themselves have evolved over the years?
Yeah,
I mean,
do we have
a system that is antithetical to what we need to do to deal with today's threats?
You know, most people don't realize this, but it was against the law to use the Internet for commercial purposes until 1992. And that's because it was developed as a research tool, and the people who designed it didn't think it needed a security layer to it. And that reminds me of the telephone system in a way as it existed when I was a kid. You know, I remember when I was 10 or 11 watching some 18-year-old with this little gizmo that made it sound like you were dropping quarters into the payphone,
mm-hmm.
and the operator would basically give him free long-distance calls because he had a gizmo to make the sound without dropping the money. And that's because when the way the phone system was engineered then, the security payment layer went through the same channel as your voice, which was the content. And later, AT&T pulled the security layer into a different channel, so you couldn't do that. You can't do that anymore. But that's how the Internet works. The security and the content are in the same layer. And in the long run, I think we need to re-engineer that. But that's not going to happen for a long time. That's expensive, and it would take a lot of research. Meanwhile, if people want to download things from places they don't know, if they want to take somebody else's thumb drive and stick it into their USB port, they need to understand that they're exposing themselves to all kinds of electronic diseases. And companies can tighten themselves up in the ways that I've suggested before. So there are a lot of things that really can be done to make us more secure.
When we see situations where the government, more specifically the Defense Department, like the story this week with respect to the keystrokes on the drone controls, that the government is vulnerable, it's hard to imagine corporations, as you say, being at a point where they're protected.
There's no such thing as perfect protection now. People think in terms of strong boxes and locks and all that. It's we got to throw those images out. In software, a lock is just a figure of speech. It consists of ones and zeros, of bits of information. And if you can get into the system, you can change the ones and zeros and open the lock. It's more like the kind of organic system that lets our bodies stay healthy most of the time, even though we've got lots of bad germs in us all the time. And we need to begin to conceive of and engineer systems that work that way. So that, yeah, transparency is with us, and there are fewer secrets to be kept, whether at the personal privacy level or the national level. But it doesn't mean there aren't some real steps to be taken. And this book lays out both what's going on in the intelligence business, in the military, and in corporate life, because we're also suggests what we can do about it.
Talk about the military for a moment, because there's always the assumption that that's kind of a closed system, the metaphor being maybe a kind of sterile environment, but that environment can be invaded as well.
Well, I tell some stories that explain how it's been invaded, as it has been invaded. And one of the ways it happens, you know, on the cover of the book, there's a picture of a thumb drive. Thumb drives are carriers of electronic diseases. They're also, you know, they're marvelously productive and efficient. You can put a million pages of text dangling on the end of your keychain. I mean, it's extraordinary. That's also changed espionage. You can walk out with a million pages of somebody else's information at the end of your keychain too. But when I tell some stories about things in how this sort of thing works, and I use the example of some things in Bagram that I can't describe real operations, but I really explain how it happens. And when your kid comes home with some thumb drive that he got from somewhere else and sticks it in your computer, you don't know, or when you stick yours in his computer, you don't know what's on that. And we have seen intelligence agencies use these thumb drives to propagate malware that then beacons out stolen information over the Internet. That's also how the Stuxnet business worked in Iran. If some of your listeners remember,
right.
You know, where we made their centrifuge, or somebody made their centrifuges go haywire. Because if you can get into the system to steal stuff, you can get into it to make it go haywire. And that was done partly with thumb drives to get into isolated systems.
And, of course, as you point out, more and more of our systems here, not just corporate and military, but the basic infrastructure of the country is becoming more and more connected.
Look, it's a marvelous world in many respects. You know, Jeff, we love it.
Right.
I mean, you walk down the street, nobody's looking at where they're going. They're looking at the gizmo in their hand. We love this. And we love the fact that we get information that we want, and that we stay in touch with people we want to stay in touch with. We don't know what to do when we're disconnected anymore. And we also give away huge amounts of information about ourselves. I mean, you know, you go buy a refrigerator, you want to buy it on credit. This afternoon, you can get credit instantly. Why? Because that merchant is connected with some bureau that knows vast amounts of information about you. And if they tell you, no, you can't have credit, you get angry. You also get angry when you realize how much information there is out there about you. But you've given it away, so have I. We give it away to the grocery store. We give it away to the highway when we pass through an electronic toll booth to keep from waiting in line. You know, if you want a mortgage or enter the hospital, you have to give away even more information.
Right.
All this stuff's available now. Stealable.
Do we make a mistake? Does it make it harder to deal with the corporate and governmental aspects of this if we lump it all together? Because on the personal security level, that genie seems to be beyond out of the proverbial bottle. We are giving away that information. You know, it's the old line from Scott McNeely, there is no privacy, get over it.
Yeah.
But do we need to separate in our thinking and the porousness with which we approach this, the corporate and governmental security needs from the rest of the personal needs?
Well, it depends. If you mean separate it because we need to understand it differently, then I don't agree with that. I think we need to understand it as all part of the same phenomenon of transparency and this huge sea of data in which we swim. And we is you and me, it's our employer, and it's our government. If you mean that we need to separate the rules that apply to us and companies and government, then I certainly agree with you. I mean, we do need to have rules that give us some protection in the way our data is used and so on. But by and large, we are in a post-secrecy, post-privacy environment, and this is true whether we're the government or a company or us. Secrets, personal and organizational, will be harder and harder to keep, and they will stay secret for less and less time. I like to think of secrets having a half-life,
right,
like an isotope. And that half-life's getting short. And that's true up and down the ladder, you, me, organizations.
Is there some benefit in that? I mean, the degree to which all secrets are suddenly out there and there are no secrets anymore, it's a kind of mutually assured destruction model that we saw during the Cold War.
You know, talking about whether it's good or bad is like asking whether gravity's good or bad. It's a condition of life. And it's very important, though, Jeff, that people understand that you cannot have unlimited amounts of transparency and unlimited amounts of privacy. They are antithetical. And we want privacy and we want transparency. We have to really, the country needs to think much harder about this, because transparency is not an absolute virtue unless you regard modesty, tact, and reticence as absolute vices, and no one does.
Mm-hmm. Will technology solve this? Can we look to technology as the panacea?
You know, a few years ago I was out in Silicon Valley, and I was still in the government, and I was talking to a group of entrepreneurs, and they were begging me to tell them what was the black box that the government wanted them to invent to make this problem go away. And I had to say, fellas, there is no black box that will make this go away. As we've discussed, there are changes in the way the Internet works that would be really helpful. And there are technologies that we could imagine that would be really helpful. But carelessness in the way we behave is not a technological problem. And a company's failure to employ available technology to know what's running on its own systems, for example, Jeff, that's not a technological problem. That's a management problem. And right now, we haven't even got our hands on the easy stuff, let alone the hard technology.
And, of course, as you talked about at the, in the beginning, there is a huge economic cost to all of this.
There is. Look, there are economic benefits, too. I mean, this technology has made us dramatically more productive, and it has also created a dramatic amount of pleasure. We don't want to stop that. We don't want to lock this up. But we need to begin to operate in different ways. And to some extent, that means coming to grips with, hey, there's more stuff that's public now. Hypocrisy is harder. That's good. it's not an unadulterated good. And I'm concerned about the slow, relentless sucking out of American technology that creates jobs and wealth. You know, you wake up one day and find you have this wonderful technology, but somebody, how'd that guy over there across the ocean, one ocean or the other, how'd he get it? And why is he opening a factory and hiring, and I'm closing one and laying people off? That's what's at stake here.
To the extent that the corporate world becomes more savvy about this, and it at the very least takes advantage of the maximum security that exists today or even tomorrow, to what extent, to what percent, will that ameliorate some of the problem?
Oh, I think it's going to help a lot. It's not going to deal with the very most sophisticated state-sponsored attacks. That's a hard, hard problem. But companies say to me, people said to me, you know, I was in negotiations with the Chinese and they must have been reading my email because they knew all of my bottom line positions when I went into the negotiation on day one. And I say, yes, of course they were reading your email. You got to understand that. I've got some very good advice for travelers, by the way, that I wrote when I was in counterintelligence. It's on the National Counterintelligence Executive's website. It's www.ncix.com, advice for travelers. It's still good advice.
And one of the things that you talk about is the fact that, you know, even your cell phone and whatever information is in it is probably going to get hacked while you're there.
Oh, if you go to China and you're there on a business visit to negotiate, you will be turned inside out. And and the danger is not only that your communications will be monitored in real time, but that malware will be inserted through your smartphone or your laptop that will then migrate back to your server at home and have the potential for bleeding out secrets continually. That's the real danger.
Joel Brenner, the book is America the Vulnerable, Inside the New Threat Matrix of Digital Espionage, Crime, and Warfare. Joel, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.